This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first Zurich Financial Services Distinguished Visitor on Climate Change. This program is an endowed program that was funded by Zurich Financial Services to allow us to attract international leaders in policy and law and business and science on the area of climate change and its impact on the planet and people. And we're delighted today to have Margaret Davidson, who is the director of the Office of Coastal Resources Management at NOAA, as our speaker in this program. Margaret has been a leader in coastal ocean resource management since the late 1970s. She has a JD in natural resources law from Louisiana State University and a master's in marine policy and resource economics from the University of Rhode Island. She's on the faculty at the University of Charleston and has adjunct appointments at both Clemson and the University of South Carolina. You participate in every university in South Carolina, I see. Yes, okay. And her expertise is very diverse, spanning a whole variety of topics from sustainable aquaculture to coastal hazards to the impacts of climate variability on ocean natural resources. And she's personally experienced that impact of climate variability in several different settings. One of them impacted us because this talk was originally scheduled for early in the year, but it was canceled as a result of Superstorm Sandy. But Margaret's a real trooper, and so she wasn't going to let that deter her coming to speak with us today. Even with a detached retina today, she is here determined to give us her talk. And so we're really delighted to have her today. And Margaret's talk today is entitled, How Big Should My Water Wings Be? Coastal Risk Awareness and Management. Please welcome Margaret Davidson.
So, can everyone hear me all right first? Okay, thank you. I didn't actually intend to be here doing my best impression of Johnny Depp. So, forgive me if I'm going to be a little challenged here. Secondly, as I always must do, anything that I say that is outrageous is certainly not the opinion of the agency that employs me. Okay. So, this Zurich program is about exposing you folks to what's going on in terms of climate change and climate adaptation issues, and I am grateful to Zurich Financial for this opportunity. I've actually been working with them for a while. They are one of the big boys in this field. Oh, well. Big boys and girls. I use that in the Northeast sense of the phrase, you know, boys, guys, it's a generic thing, it's not a gender-based thing. Really, you know, you guys. So, anyway, I'm delighted to be here and to see you folks. And so let's rock away here. And I'm going to talk for about 40, 45 minutes, kind of off the slides. There's no test, of course. And then we're going to allow about 20 minutes for questions if you guys actually have something to say or ask or whatever. Okay. So, and the slides are really for your amusement. There's not going to be anything highly detailed on them. So let's go. So, like all great nations and great cities, America was born on the coast. 19 out of 21 of the world's largest estuaries are on the coast, of course, because the coast, since we came together in settlements, were the place where we could find food, waste disposal, and transportation. So that's the reason why most of the world's major settlements are on the coast. Now, of course, as you all know from the edge effect, I can't see this one too well. A little dimmer up there would be great. But this is a satellite composite of the world at night. So all you really have to do is squint your eyes, and you can actually see the outline of every continent because that's where the people are. So in the U.S., back of the envelope, we're talking around maybe 60, 70 million people, and worldwide, back of the envelope, something about 660 million people are very close to the ocean. And in the U.S., as you may know, since the 70s, there was a great push towards the coast. It was only slightly abated in the 90s and the 2000s with a major push towards the Southwest Desert. But some of those people have figured out that there's no water there. And in the last decade, the latest census confirmed for us that people are actually rushing back to the coast like the lemmings that we are. So why are coasts important? Well, one of the reasons the coasts are important, besides the fact that it's many the people living within a relatively short distance from the water's edge, what you need to know is the coastal counties make up about 60% of the gross domestic product. That's the term that we use to measure the health of our economy. So most of the nation's economic activity is taking place right at the water's edge, and as I will show you, we actually drive even more than that, of course, because there are three principal water-dependent uses. The first one is ports. In fact, 90% of almost everything that America consumes comes from someplace else, and it comes through a port. This is actually a map of truck flows out of the Port of New Orleans. And it can show you that even if you're in Nebraska, you care what happens in the Port of New Orleans. And I like this because even before I only had one eye, I could look at it and it almost looked like a hydrology map from USGS as well. So keep that in mind. That's a very important issue. The other two truly water-dependent uses, of course, are the Navy and the Marines. And that's one of the reasons why the Navy is leading on issues related to climate change for this country at the federal level. So we are a coastal nation, even if we're waiting to get our seafood up in Omaha. And, of course, we all love the coast. You guys know this. It's a terrible vista you got right out there. In fact, we're actually in some places loving our coast to death. I'm sure a number of you are working on marine pollution issues or marine debris issues. So with the people and with the economic activity comes everything else that we bring with ourselves, of course. But here's this little convergence between what our heart's desires want us to do, have a great vista, and what Mother Nature is telling us. So in the last couple of years, on every continent and in every category of natural disasters, we've had record-breaking years. And back in the time of Katrina, the dark ages of a decade ago, we talked then about how we were going to have the mega-billion-dollar disasters on a regular basis. In fact, in 2009, which was actually the 70th anniversary of the Long Island Express, which was a major storm to hit New England, there were a series of papers that showed if a storm like that were to hit the Northeast, it could be a $50 to $100 billion storm. And I'll get back to that one in a minute, because it turns out we were right. But what you can see is that as we plotted along, not only is there a greater frequency in extreme events, and I'll speak a little bit more about that, but there's also a greater cost associated with it. Now, some of that, of course, is a part of the changes in dollar value and the changes in property values, even with the last 6 years, but the rest of it is just straight up cost. The other thing you also need to know is that when we report on the costs of a particular event like Sandy, those costs are only the privately and publicly reimbursed costs. So whatever Zurich pays out, State Farm, Allstate, Nationwide, as well as the flood insurance program and some continuity of business stuff out of the Small Business Administration and some other things. What is not included in that are social and environmental costs. A study by the Heinz Center about 15 years ago said that if you have a $20 billion disaster as reported, then it's probably, once you include in those other costs, it's probably closer to a $40 billion disaster. But I'm going to assume that at a place like Bryn, you already know about the challenges of shadow values and how do we account for these kinds of things. And this is actually a really important topic because here's why it's important. Environmental costs, I'm going to assume you all know a little something about that topic. How do we measure it? How do we prove it? How do we monetize it? There's that. Social costs. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the increase in domestic abuse and mental health centers that occur right after a major event. They spike, and then they'll continue for 2 to 3 years afterwards. And nobody reimburses that local community for those recurring costs. Not Uncle Sugar, not the State House. Those are local costs. So even as those local politicians are sitting there saying, oh, we're not so bad, look at all the construction activity that we've had after this event, look at all these revenues coming in. At the same time, social services are really struggling. So one of the things we have to figure out in this country is how do we actually do a better accounting of the full range of true costs associated with these events, because I think it would really blow some people's minds. So, risk. What is risk? Well, risk is actually a very individual thing. It's of course, a function of where you are geographically and culturally. It's also a function of your geomorphology and a function of your exposure to Mother Nature. So let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, geomorphology. This is a USGS map. I notice it is stronger on the East Coast than the West Coast. You'll forgive them for that. We'll talk to the guys up in Menlo Park about that. But function of geomorphology, so if you're up in New England, you're a little less concerned about shoreline erosion than from the mid-Atlantic through the Gulf of Mexico. And then in California, it's a mixed bag, depending upon which one of the seven Californias you're in, and how erosive your cliff is. And so it's a little different situation here. And then if you're in places that are uplifting, so in portions of the West Coast and portions of Alaska, it's less of an issue than the subsiding erosive coast. So part of it is just your geomorphology. What kind of coast are you on? And what are the other forces affecting it? If you're in a place like South Louisiana, where it's nothing but grass, it's also had a lot of human-related insults. Your erosive factor can be even substantially higher. And this is some of the latest data off of South Louisiana, which is eroding so much faster than we thought it was, even just a few years ago. They are actually toast. We've been speaking of them for years as the analog for understanding the impacts of sea level rise, and they are actually good for that. However, they're not a great analog for understanding how one might address the impacts of sea level rise. We'll get back to that one, too. And here's another thing. It's also a function of what is your population. So social vulnerability. How many elderly, poor, sick, disadvantaged people are there? That's part of your exposure to risk. If you're all rich and you can get the hell out of Dodge or you can afford to rebuild or whatever, it's not as big of a deal as if you're on a limited income or no income, or if you're an elderly person who has three pets at home, because even the most progressive of shelters only allow one pet. What if you're one of those little old lady hoarders who also keeps all the cats and stray cats and dogs? Where do you go? And you laugh, but this has been a real issue, not just in South Louisiana, but in every place. And then, of course, if you're also in New Orleans and you happen to live in a geomorphological bowl, you also have challenges as well. But for the last decade, so I'm from the Gulf Coast, I grew up in Texas, I spent most of my professional life in enlightened places like South Louisiana, and Colorado, and Rhode Island, and Thailand, and D.C. For the last decade, you know, I've listened to a lot of people talk about what a bunch of dumbasses we rednecks from the Gulf were for living where we lived. Now, I will tell you, we weren't actually that big of a dumbass, because until fairly recently, the last 20, 25 years when I was growing up, you didn't actually spend a lot of money on your residence or your property at the beach. In fact, when I was growing up, it was really much more of a plywood kind of construction. And if some storm came through, you'd get your cousins and friends and a keg of beer and have a seafood cookout, and you'd take care of the problem. But what we have seen in the last, well, two things happened. The period of the headlong rush to the coast during the 60s and 70s was actually accompanied by an anomalous period in atmospheric events, meaning there weren't very many coastal storms then. So most folks didn't actually have that experience. And secondly, the nature of coastal residential dwellings morphed substantially during the 70s and 80s from these little shacks that I knew growing up to the McMansions that are so prevalent. In fact, the place with the greatest repetitive loss is actually the itsy-bitsy coastal shoreline of Alabama. There's a place on Dauphin Island. There's a great photo montage of this one particular site on Dauphin Island, which since 1979 has been rebuilt, damaged and rebuilt half a dozen times, each time to a bigger footprint and much more expensively. So that's what we call the flood insurance program. I'm hoping that you learned a little something about it. And let me say, I appreciate your subsidizing my living on the coast. I live in Charleston, South Carolina at 5.5 feet. So this isn't a professional issue. This is a personal issue as well. It's my ox that I am actually trying to gore in my professional life. But since Sandy, the conversation has changed somewhat. Now, why has it changed? Well, first of all, it's been a decade since Katrina. And let's say there's been a lot more information and publication about issues related to climate change. Secondly, there's an axiom in political science that which governs best is a benevolent dictator. And certainly Mayor Bloomsburg does meet that qualification. Maybe that there's a higher level of education in New Jersey and in New York City than there is in South Louisiana or Mississippi or Alabama. Unfortunately, there is often a kernel of truth in some stereotypes. And that may be one of those kernels of truth. I remember when I was about your age and I was actually living in Denver, Colorado, in a house full of folks who were actually going to med school and law school. And they were from the East Coast and the West Coast, and they had all gone to private schools. And though they had traveled the world before, none of them had ever been to the South. And they actually didn't have any friends who went to public school. And I remember when I first started living with them that they were amazed that not only had I come out of public schools and a university in Louisiana, but I could walk and I could chew gum at the same time and I could string together a complete sentence. Now, we all get what we want to get out of education wherever it happens. Now, you just happen to be lucky at Bryn because you have exposure to lots of excellent resources. At LSU, it was easier to find the few excellent professors and to glom onto them. But wherever you are, whatever situation, this is a parenthetical, you can make the most out of it. So the conversation has changed substantially since Sandy. And people like Bloomsburg and Governor Cuomo and even Governor Christie, well, Governor Christie doesn't use the C word, climate, but he does talk about the importance of rebuilding in a resilient fashion. And the dialogue has been so much different. So let me give you one example about that. After Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, my shop actually worked very closely with FEMA to turn around in record time the advisory base flood elevation maps. Before Katrina, it had actually taken them 6 months to turn them around, and in that time, lots of people would have rebuilt. After Katrina, we turned them around in 6 weeks, and we all pridefully went down to the Mississippi coast and unveiled these elevation maps, and were cannon fodder. Well, just last week, up in New York and New Jersey, we unveiled those advisory base flood elevation maps again. And the states of New York and the states of New Jersey are embracing it, and many local communities will as well. Particularly New York City already has. It's going to be a mixed report on the New Jersey coast because the embracing of these maps is tied to your flood insurance rates and depending upon what the governors decide in negotiation with the federal government, may have some bearing on the amount of reimbursement that you get as well. Just this past summer, we snuck onto the transportation bill, because that's how we do it in D.C. these days, since we can't actually move real legislation. We look for pork legislation, and we stick interesting stuff on that. And in the dark of the night, we passed the Biggert's Waters Flood Reform Act. And what does that mean? Well, people in New York and New Jersey are going to learn about that right now. And what it basically means, bottom line, is if you have a house that's substantially damaged and you rebuild, either with flood insurance or not, well, if you're rebuilding on your own, you can do whatever you want. It is a free country. But if you're using flood insurance money and you're rebuilding, then you have to elevate, and your insurance rates are going to go up, depending upon how high you elevate. So my house, which is only 70 years old, has never been damaged under the flood insurance program, so it's grandfathered. So my insurance rates are going to begin climbing gradually, starting with this next year. But if my house had been substantially damaged and I was rebuilding, even if I elevated it, my insurance rates would climb even more substantially, like on the order of about 25% a year. What are we trying to do? We're actually trying to have the flood insurance program be based on actuarial risk, so that it actually has some relationship to the real risk to which the property is exposed. Because it really isn't fair for you folks here in Santa Barbara or the folks in Omaha to underwrite my Great Vista. Although I will tell you, on the Audubon weekend in December, I counted 19 species in one afternoon in my backyard. So that was very cool. But I digress. So the discussion has changed a lot. And what is going on? Well, one of the things that we're also rolling out, besides the advisory-based flood elevation recommendations, which are based on the surge data. So that's trend data. It's recent trend data. What was the surge plus one? That's the recommendation for rebuilding in New York City and the New Jersey coast. The other thing is this sea level rise issue, which is based on model projections. Now, these particular curves are actually from the last IPCC process. So it's about a decade old, and we're actually just beginning that again. But what's actually on the web right now is the National Climate Assessment. That's our domestic version of the IPCC. It's out there on the web, and for the first time ever, we developed sea level rise scenarios for the U.S. And the public comment period ended last week, so in the next 3 weeks, we're going to be addressing 4,000 comments on that document, and we'll get back to you. But basically, what we're also rolling out in New York and New Jersey are some sea level rise viewing tools as well for those folks who want to not only look at the elevation issue, but who actually might want to take on a slightly longer time scale than right now, getting back to business. Because if you've been hit by a storm, the first thing you want to do is just get back to where you were before. And if you're in New Jersey, 70% of the revenue in those beach towns, the things that pay for schools and police and fire protection, are coming from those summer tourists. So you can kind of see there might be a little political tension between how do we rebuild smarter and how do we rebuild quickly enough so that we can bring in that money this summer that actually sustains our cities. So that's always the dynamic tension. So why is the rate of sea level rise increasing? I presume you guys already know this stuff, so I'm not going to go into great depths about it. But let's just say that in the last decade, we've discovered that our model projections for how fast the Greenland ice sheet would melt way underestimated the collapse of the ice sheet. Because why? Well, we were scientists, so we were only looking at how fast it would melt if the sun reflected off the top of the surface and how much the top would melt. But lo and behold, in the last decade, we realized that actually the major melting is going on underneath. It's collapsing from underneath. And a river runs through it. It's not just a Brad Pitt movie. It's actually what's happening with the Greenland ice sheet melt. Now, you guys don't care. You're on the Pacific Ocean. So there's this little thing called the West Antarctic Ice Shelf. Now, for you, sea level rise is actually a little less troublesome of an issue than it is on the East Coast because, first of all, this ice sheet is collapsing rapidly, and complete collapse of this ice sheet could actually raise the height of the Atlantic Ocean by about 5 meters. And the Atlantic is actually a small and relatively shallow bathtub compared to the Pacific. In contrast, your issue out here, really, more seriously, is ocean acidification. Because I'm going to assume at the Brin School that you learned that not only is the Pacific bigger in terms of aerial extent and volume, but it's also much older waters. So when we talk about sequestration, when we talk about carbon sequestration, the Pacific Ocean has actually been the buffer for all of us for a long time. And now it's got a bellyache, and TUMS is not going to solve the ocean acidification problem. And the fascinating thing about ocean acidification is this, to me anyway. I've been working on this sea level rise issue myself since the early 80s. But ocean acidification, 20 years ago, there was maybe a handful of really geeky guys who talked about this, and it wasn't anywhere in the literature, and you didn't read anything about it. And in fact, it was only in the last decade when we began to string together coastal and ocean observing systems that we realized that something was happening more than one place at one point in time, that there was something systemic going on in the Pacific. So last year, in many marinas along the West Coast, barnacles failed to form. Now, if you happen to own a boat, you might think that's a really great thing. But when you think about things like coccoliths and krill as the basis of the Pacific Ocean food chain, and their shellfish, and ocean acidification inhibits calcium carbonate formation. So if there are no coccoliths and there are no krill, then what happens to our charismatic megafauna to begin with? So my guys at the sanctuary, they'd be out of business, right? And then those shellfish growers already in the Pacific Northwest and other places are very concerned about it. It has profound implications, this ocean acidification stuff. You know, sea level rise, if only we were smart enough, we know how to elevate and harden. If we had the cojones, we might even figure out how to retreat. But you know what? We haven't figured out what to do about this ocean acidification thing. There have been some grand geoengineering ideas that have been out there. But, you know, the scale of the challenge is such that we don't know about that. So there's this little thing called the precautionary principle. So, interesting little question. So the Pacific Ocean is going acidic. And iron fertilization may be an experiment, a 100-mile by 100-mile experiment to see if we can actually slow down that pH problem. But there are a lot of issues associated with an experiment that size. And the precautionary principle says that you don't do anything until you understand all the consequences. But, you know, in the time in which it might take us to understand all those consequences, we might actually have moved past the point at which we could have any impact. Now, I myself am not a particularly big fan of engineers, or geoengineering for that matter, but the scale of our problem is such that I think that we're also going to have to figure out how we think about problem solutions differently than we have before. So how do we know that this climate stuff is not just the way that people like you all get money to do research? Well, I myself like to talk about trend lines and not model projections. So here's one I find very compelling from the big boys, Munich Re. Reinsurance guys are the guys who bail out the casualty loss insurance guys when they make a bad bet on you. I should have a slide from Zurich, but I don't. But Zurich and Munich and Lloyd's of London, they're among the big people on this issue, and they've been on the climate change train for a while. Because the increase in the frequency and severity of atmospherically driven events is undeniable. That's a trend line. That's not a model projection. As opposed to, say, the increase in the frequency and severity of earthquakes is relatively constant. As you all know, there are both short and long waves. in everything that happens in life over time. But what we're seeing in terms of weather patterns is substantially different than anything that we've seen at least in the last 14,000 years. And great news about the U.S., only Indonesia has more natural disasters than we do. So not only are we having more frequent and severe events, we're actually having more expensive events. I've been spending a lot of time in the last decade working with a lot in the business community who we might in this room refer to as climate deniers. Yesterday, I gave the opening talk at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Sustainability Symposium. Now, at the Chamber, I don't talk about climate because that's verboten. I talk about extreme events. But you know what? It doesn't really matter because at least for drought, wildfire, and coastal inundation, everything that we want communities and society to do to minimize our risk exposure, our future losses, is exactly the same, regardless of if we're talking on a weather timescale right now or a climate timescale 10 years from now, 30 years from now. And there's this other little weird policy issues for you policy guys. So there's this thing that we call cost-benefit analysis. You may have run into it a little bit. We set up that approach back in the 70s when we were passing a lot of environmental legislation. And 40 years ago, there may have been a reason to steeply discount the future. That's no longer the case. Our knowledge set has evolved dramatically in the last 40 years. And one of the things I think we really need to do in this country is also rethink how we approach cost-benefit analysis. So how do you begin to change the public's mind when there's been such an active campaign to say that we are all wackadoodle, those of us who talk about climate? Well, first of all, you recognize that as people in the scientific community and people in the public sector, you really don't have much status on this issue. There are other people who actually can be more effective in communicating these issues than sometimes people like us. And that sometimes the easiest way to lead people to new thought process is not necessarily with words. It can actually be with pictures, you know, simple tools that they can use themselves. This was actually developed for a slideshow that I did more than a year ago, and I talked about when the Long Island Express of 39 would recur again. We now call that Superstorm Sandy. And just like when Katrina hit New Orleans, everything that happened in New York and New Jersey when Sandy hit, we already knew that. We had actually had studies. We had been talking about it. Bloomsburg had even already taken measures to try and protect some of the subways and some other infrastructure, or else it would have been far, far greater damage. Now, one of the ironies is that since Sandy happened, is the city of New York is so much more open to some innovative solutions than the coast of New Jersey, and I'll talk about that. But that's a function of a lot of things, including Bloomsburg, the benevolent dictator. I personally have done 180 twist on my view of him over the last 10 years as mayor. I think he's been a phenomenal mayor, and I hope that when he has to step down because he's term limited, he'll continue being in the public eye because clearly he has cojones, and that's what policy processes require. So I've been talking about risk from one side, so let's talk about risk from the other side. Who pays? When we're talking about coastal flooding risk, I hope you've already gotten the impression that we all pay. We all pay right now. That's what the flood insurance program is about. And there's some people who actually want to extend the way that the flood insurance works to all hazards. There's been a bill introduced in Congress each year for the last 5 years to do the same thing for earthquakes and for wildfires and for drought. Now, drought's a little different, actually, than those other events because there are fewer things that you can do from a structural standpoint that relate to drought, except from a hydrological management, dams and all that kind of thing. So that's a really dumb idea. But even with that flood reform that I told you that we snuck in the dark of night in July, there's already an effort underway in the House of Representatives to turn that back now that they fully understand the potential implications of what it implies for people like me, but more especially right now for people in New York City and New Jersey. So we're all at risk, because we share in the burden of the flood insurance program. And this didn't matter so much even a few years ago, because how we handled emergency supplementals, they were all off budget. It was like funny money, like Monopoly money. But with the Budget Reconciliation Act of a few years ago that's given us these great federal budgets and now sequestration, emergency supplementals actually have to come out of the regular federal budget process. That's one of the reasons why all those people in the upper Midwest who got flooded out last year, they didn't see an emergency supplemental. In fact, the only reason we got one now is there's a lot of people in New York and New Jersey, and we got one. But that money is going to put squeeze on the rest of the domestic programs even more than sequestration and the whole budget issue has. So you need to be thinking about these emergency supplementals and recognizing that every time they happen, that means that there's less money from almost every program that you know, because the discretionary part of the federal budget is only about 10%. So I'm talking about all the environmental agencies you know, all the health agencies you know. I'm not talking about Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. And I'm not talking about DOD, of course, or the Department of Homeland Security. But I am talking about everything that you know is less than 10% of the federal budget, right? Payment on the debt, DOD, DHS, that's a huge hunk of money. And the rest of us have to eat the emergency supplemental. So it's a great day. Not going to be so many Fed jobs in the very near future. So this is for my buddies at the Corps. There are a number of things that we can do about addressing risk, but clearly some of the most important things that we can do are planning, zoning, and building. And you know what? That's not a Fed role. That's not even a Sacramento role. That's entirely the province of local government. So the good news is that in the absence of national leadership and in the absence of most governors leading on this issue, there are over 1,000 mayors who in the last decade have signed on to the climate compact in this country. And that's great, because how we're going to affect our future exposure is at the local government level. And that's the level that I would encourage you to focus on, because that's where the most meaningful decisions are in fact being made these days. So we can do these through structural, non-structural. We can do it through insurance. A lot of people say, well, why don't we just raise the cost of insurance? Well, it's this simple. Most state insurance commissioners are either themselves elected or they're appointed by elected officials. And how many states besides Governor Moonbeam get elected by saying, I'm going to raise your taxes, I'm going to raise your utility rates, I'm going to raise your insurance rates? It's usually a death knell for your political career to say those things these days. So raising insurance is a challenge unless we can do it in the dark of night. So there are other things that we can do, but planning, local planning, zoning, and building codes are where it is at. And how much it costs to adapt to climate change also is a function of where you're at. So if you're in Maryland, which is at the top of that list, this is the insured value of coastal properties by state. Well, there's actually, on the coastline of Maryland, there's actually not a lot of folks. They tend to want to be within commuting distance to D.C. In contrast, look at New York and Florida, who are at the bottom of the list. So in a place like Florida, where you have a Tea Party governor who's busy dismantling everything in state government, and of course, not only doesn't believe in climate change, I don't even think he believes in extreme weather, five counties in South Florida have gotten it together, and they've gotten themselves some Fed money, they put together county money, and they're moving out on it. And why? Because it's very palpable. I mean, once a week I get an image sent to me of Highway A1A underwater, because A1A is the lifeblood from Miami to the Keys. If you're standing in Miami, it's easy to tell what a low-lying place that you're in. So they're taking it very seriously in the south of Florida, even not in Tallahassee. So some states actually happen to be more endowed than other states. California, well, you do know that we do refer to you guys on the right coast. We refer to you guys on the left coast, of course, is the granola state, right? Fruit, nuts, and flakes. But when it comes to this climate issue, you guys are way out ahead. You even had the gubernator on it, right? But you also have local communities who've been working these issues for the last decade and doing some very cool things. Seattle has also been a leader in this issue. In fact, if everyone were more like you guys, well, except for Orange County, who knows how far we could get on this issue. Because the way I like to talk about this issue is we're avoiding future costs. Now, any of you who studied this area know that, first of all, it's a challenge to monetize avoided costs, right? And it's even harder to figure out how to market avoided costs. So in addition to the science and the economics, I would stress that you need to learn about communication, in particular risk communication, no matter what your particular thing is. If you are not able to adequately communicate to normal people what you're talking about, you won't be very effective. Okay? So, let's see, where are we? After every major event over the last decade, the first thing that happens is on these coastal storms, people say, I want to be like the Dutch. Give me one of those storm surge barriers. We saw this after Katrina in New Orleans. We saw this after Ike in Galveston, Texas. We heard this up in New York City after Sandy. And I say, great. If we want to be like the Dutch, then let's learn from the Dutch experience. And what is the Dutch experience? Thousands of years holding back the sea with a dike, right? Engineering. In fact, the Dutch are the world's engineers. Just go to Southeast Asia. They've been modifying it for the last few hundred years substantially. It's like the Army Corps. It's a lifetime security. You go in, you engineer, and then 30 years later, when you discovered it screwed up, you get to go back and re-engineer. We've been re-engineering the Florida Everglades for the last 20 years anyway. But the Dutch experience is this. 3 decades ago, they realized that they could no longer hold back the sea with a concrete barrier, such as they had been doing. And they began designing a storm surge barrier for the 10,000-year storm. Let me repeat that. The 10,000-year storm. We can't even design a levee for the 100-year storm in this country. And the Dutch are designing it for a 10,000-year storm. And they erected this weir for Rotterdam at a cost of about $100 billion. And then they said, lo and behold, it is insufficient. We cannot afford to protect all of the Netherlands like this. And what have they been doing in the last decade? Well, they've developed 2 new buzz phrases. One is called design with nature. And the next one is make room for the river. And I like to joke, I have hopes for the Army Corps of Engineers because the generals have been over there 5 times in the last 5 years. So maybe it will yet happen. So what the Dutch are doing is this. Offshore, they're developing what we would call underwater berms, rills, to slow down the waves coming in. They're remediating and restoring wetlands where they have them. They are putting up earthenworks. They're also elevating and hardening critical infrastructure that is in the highly exposed zone. And they've begun a process by which they're moving people out of low-lying marginal areas that they can't afford to protect. So that is the Dutch experience. Okay? It's what us wonks call ecosystem services, if you happen to be ecologically trained, or green infrastructure, as this slide says. Although I have to tell you that a recent set of Nature Conservancy focus groups says that normal people don't get ecosystem services and they don't get green infrastructure, but what does resonate with them is nature's defenses. So I change my language substantially when I'm talking to normal people, not you all. And I talk about nature's defenses because they intuitively grok what that means. whereas they're not sure what this means. Now, what this is about is the fact that we need to take a systems approach at a landscape scale to designing both gray, concrete, and green infrastructure. Right now, the way it really happens is like this. The boys who pour concrete, be they the Department of Transportation or EPA with water and sewer funding or HUD with housing or the Army Corps with navigation and flood protection works, are major real estate developers. They got the plans for where they want to pour concrete. And us poor schleps in the public sector, we go into a pre-permit hearing, and we're looking at their plans, and they've already made their plans. They've spent a lot of money on architectural and engineering drawings. They've probably spent a lot of money on lawyers. Thank you very much. And all we're doing is literally and metaphorically negotiating at the margins how to make it slightly less devastating to Mother Nature. We're not actually thinking about it from a systems approach. Now, we do have some really good data on some of this. The Tennessee Valley Authority, which is all about engineering, has a lot of really good data about constructed wetlands and the value that they provide for tertiary treatment of sewage waste. Okay. Now, in the coastal domain, it's a little harder. Something about adding that salt just makes everything so much more complex. But we've got a lot more data, particularly in the last 10 to 15 years of storms, on flood attenuation and surge attenuation values. We have some fairly good data on food provisioning. We have decent but need better data on water filtration. But the fact of the matter is, and I was saying this to a group of students earlier, not only do we need to do this systems approach so that we're taking maximum value of what Mother Nature brings to the table, because she can actually protect us against floods so much more cheaply than we can, but we need to actually do a better job of monetizing.
Great talk. How do you see us overcoming the challenges to strategically relocating away from the coast?
Well, in this country, we have relocated small, highly homogeneous communities in the upper Midwest and a few other places. But we do not have a history of resettlement. And I think that is a major challenge psychologically and financially that we haven't even really admitted that we have in front of it, or in Pilkey, to the contrary. So I'm not that clear about it, but I do believe that South Louisiana and South Florida are actually the first line of learning what this means. You know, there are people who live in South Louisiana who've been down those bayous for hundreds of years. When I ran a disaster field office there in the early 70s, and I went into the Atchafalaya Basin, I found people there in 1973 who thought Roosevelt was still president. So these are people who are culturally, economically tied to where they live, and yet they've seen it vanishing before their eyes for the last 30 years, and they still don't want to move. You know, because if you've lived in the same spot of land for hundreds of years, it's a big emotional issue. So I think that's our big challenge. And I think the way you do that is there's a whole body of social science that talk about the importance of trusted intermediaries. Right? I made a little joke about how scientists and people in the public sector aren't actually viewed with a lot of respect these days. But I think that there is a way to work at the local scale with the people who run your town, at the chamber, with the Land Trust Alliance, at the Planning and Zoning Board. I think there are folks that you can begin to work with, and you bring them the facts. And I joke about the climate issue. It's kind of like golf. You have to play it where it lies. So they don't want to talk about the climate issue. You talk about the trend line, extreme events. But all you can do is put the data in front of them. And I also follow Oscar Wilde's axiom. If you want to tell people the truth, do it with humor. Otherwise, they will hate you.
Question about communicating risk is something you talked about, and in terms of where we should kind of concentrate our efforts. So, in order to get people to understand risks, you have to understand it, and then you also have to be able to communicate it. Those two different things. So, which one of those do you think is more challenging?
Communication, okay. Because You have to adapt your communication to the recipient, right? It's not just a matter of what the data show. It's how do you get to those folks, present the information in a way that they understand. So one of my little jokes that I sometimes tell is I'm starting this whole new initiative, Adopt a Troglodyte. In your family, in your neighborhood, in your civic group, in your church, mosque, or synagogue, each one of us need to teach one, okay? It's easy to stand up in front of a room of folks who are already on the same train, and we all do a lot of that, but it doesn't actually expand the affinity group. It is only when you reach out to the people who are oppositional to yourself that you can actually begin to move the dialogue. And we all have someone like that in our family or our circle of friends. They may not be our closest relative or our closest friend, but you know, just tackle the one that thinks of you as a normal, trusted individual. And if you can accomplish that, then move on to a slightly bigger target. Okay? That's how I recommend we grow the circle of trust, is by each one of us engaging at a very depoliticized way, right?
Thank you for your talk. I have to travel a lot for business internationally. I was wondering, in your own experience, are there any among the top 20 economies where the opposition party is still in public denial that we're facing a challenge in this area? Because I haven't encountered one. The debate in Europe and in Asia,
yes,
is not that there's a huge issue looming, but how do you deal with it? But when I'm in D.C. and up on the Hill, it's very hard to even have a discussion.
Well, this is true. Europe has been much further along on many environmentally related issues. Of course, they've had a while longer to screw up things and figure out how to unscrew them. Although they have slowed down on some of their climate practices with the economic downturn. In Asia, it's kind of a it depends question. What country are we talking about? Certainly those South Pacific islands are believers. Vanuatu is shopping for a new homeland, no takers yet. They really believe. And some of the other low-lying countries have been working some with Indonesia. They don't want to talk about it in terms of climate, but they actually get that sea level rise isn't so hot if you've got 10,000 islands going, right? But this is what I think the problem is. Why are we the only putative democracy on the planet that's not a parliamentary system? Why are we just two parties, two oppositional parties? You know, any other country where they pretend to elect people, they have to build coalitions to govern. And in D.C., it's win or lose. You're either on top or you're on bottom. And oppositional politics has become what we're all about. So I told the young folks earlier, the way I often describe D.C., it's like NBA. There's a lot of pushing and shoving, and not all hard fouls are called, and ties never count. You know, and that's the problem with America, among other things. That's the problem with our politics at the national level. And that's why I've actually pretty much given up on the national things, and that's why I stress the local issue.
So when you talk about the successes of Seattle and the granola state, are you talking about infrastructural changes or the attitude of the people, or what do you see as the biggest successes?
D, all of the above. So in places like San Francisco and Seattle and Chicago, they've developed climate adaptation plans, and they're beginning to think in a different way about both where they site and how they construct critical infrastructure. And non-critical infrastructure, relocating it to higher or more defensible ground. That's what is happened in some of those places, trying to roll out those kinds of policies. Because everything about where we put that infrastructure, roads, waters, and sewers, shapes where we all live. It's not us suburbanites who drive the footprint. It's our chambers of commerce and our state economic and our regional economic development authorities who drive our footprints with where they put our physical infrastructure. And that's what we have to change. And we're going to be spending a lot of money pouring concrete over the next few years. Indeed, we have to, or we're actually going to be fall further behind in the world economic game. So I think this is a great time to begin trying to affect how folks think about this. That's the reason I've engaged a lot with the Chamber in the last decade, because there's no community I've been in that they haven't been at the table that they wanted to be at the table, and in many towns they run the table. And the elected official is just their colleague. I was going to say something else, but I... But they often have picked out sites before anybody in the public sector has a clue. So a few years ago, when we helped the Mobile Regional Economic Authority develop a new master plan, one of the coolest results out of it wasn't anything that I ever had imagined would happen, but they actually decided to change the preferential site for the new steel mill from inside the 10-year floodplain to the edge of the 100-year floodplain. And to me, that's what coastal resilience is all about, right? So Mobile will grow more in that direction than right on the water where they were intending it to be initially, because it had a really great view. So I really encourage you to think about local government if you can. Besides, I think there are more employment opportunities. There are more units of local government than there are of state government.
I would have to concur on the local standpoint. There's a recent communication study that's just been produced that says on a local basis, discussions on climate, sea level rise, et cetera, environmental issues are much less politicized, polarized, because it's really about us here now.
Yes.
And so there's an opportunity to unify perspectives. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be lots of opinions, but it's much less politicized on a local basis.
Sure. You guys don't really care what they do in San Francisco Bay, and it's such an abstract. Most people identify with their watershed, even if they don't know the name of it. And that's where a lot of our community-based activism revolves around. You know, one of the other great challenges I was discussing with some of the grad students earlier today was around restoration issues. So here's a challenge for you guys. Right now in this country, we restore, and the way we measure success is the number of hectares restored, or 2 or 3 years in, how many of a keystone species there is. We do not restore to maintain or enhance ecosystem functionality. Why don't we do it? Well, one, it's hard to know. Our science is still evolving on that. Secondly, if you're in the public sector, you have to report back on what you did with all that money. You can't go to OMB and say, oh, well, we just spent all that money, but we won't know for 5 to 10 years whether or not the project actually worked. That's just not how that game works. And yet, to restore functionality is itself, it's like a soupçon. It takes time to marry. You go in and you do what you do, and then you monitor it, and you maybe tweak a little. But it could be a 5 to 10 year process before that tract of land begins to function again in the way that you want it to. So that, I think, is one of the great both scientific and policy challenges as we roll forward in the future. Besides, of course, sea level rise and ocean acidification.
Thank you. So I'm really curious, do you view yourself as in the den of the lion, or are you the lion in the den?
I believe that my superiors think of me as a professional thorn in their side. And one of my politicals called me not too long ago, and I have to admit, I was prideful about it, a Tasmanian devil. So I've always described myself as a professional agitator. Educate, agitate, organize. You know, if we do those things, it will happen. It will organically grow. You know, top down doesn't work. Not in this country. It's not going to ever really work. So let's do it from the bottom up. Because that's what people care the most about. I mean, for you guys, that other coast is really a long way away, and they're all kind of whack anyway, aren't they? So make it happen. In your family, in your neighborhood, in your church, mosque, or synagogue, or your civic group. That's where you start, where you are known and trusted the best. and seek out people with differing views, always.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.